Hello and welcome to another instalment of History Hack. Alina is here today, but she's currently choking to death, so I'm going to introduce the guest she's gone and found. She is muchly excited because today is World War II Day, and she has found for you Alan Malpass, who is a lecturer in military history at Bishop Grosseteste University. Is that right? He is also an author. The latest book is British Character and the Treatment of German Prisoners of War, 1939 to 48, which is really exciting. Have I butchered your university's name?
Oh, no, you say it how you see it, to be honest, how you read it, but I just call it BGU or BG.
Brilliant. Where does that name come from?
It's Robert Grosseteste, who was Bishop of Lincoln, founded as a teacher training college. I'm still learning a lot about the history of the university. I've only started back in July. But it's from him that they get the name.
That's brilliant. I like it. But anyway, enough about him. We're not here to talk about Bishop BG today, are we? We're here to talk about prisoners of war and how we treated them. This is going to be really interesting. So let's start. I guess let's just start right at the beginning with the World War II 101. So it begins on the 1st of September 1939. Germany invades Poland. Britain and France declare war on Germany a few days later. When are the first German prisoners of war in British hands? Where do they get them from? And what was their reception like when they got to Britain?
Well, just a little sort of preface beforehand. The plans for holding German prisoners of war in Britain, it was believed that the war was going to take place much like the Great War on the continent, but the authorities single out two camps, Grisdale Hall in the Lake District, as well as Glen Mill in Oldham, and they don't think they're going to actually hold many prisoners of war. In fact, the prisoners that would be captured would be on the continent in sort of front lines in France, wherever they might fall. So there wasn't any plans, and there wasn't really many prisoners that were captured during the sort of period of phony war. But really, it's the Kriegsmarine, the U-boat crews that the Royal Navy engage and capture, as well as a few German pilots of the Luftwaffe, and sort of in the first few months, sort of you get sort of a slow sort of drip of German prisoners coming into Britain. But the first sort of reported in the press and to the public is on the 21st of September, and it's just a small article which states that A number of German prisoners of war was spotted at a train station, so in transit to camp, and a woman shouted to them, "Hard luck," to which one of the Germans responded, "Ah, not so hard," as in actually we're out of the war. It's all over for us now. So everything's going to be
spot of gardening and agriculture and whatever else you can throw at us, and no imminent death. It's interesting to compare. So of First World War, obviously. So I think they came in at Southampton the first lot, and there were big crowds who wanted a rubberneck at the Germans coming in. Well, they marched them through the streets, so it was kind of they were paraded down to, I think it was Frimley / Camberley where they kept them, wasn't it? So it seems like it's a lot more low-key.
It's I'd say it is more low key, but in terms of the reaction of the small number of people who would have seen them, it's very much the same mixture. And sort of the historians of the First World War POWs in Britain have noticed it's this mixture of sort of curiosity and sort of a little bit of excitement. Because it's probably the first time for many that they've actually seen a German in the flesh, so it did cause a bit of excitement. But it's for both world wars and in this sort of the first months of the Second World War, it is this sort of curiosity, There's no sort of big disturbances. And it's, I think, yeah, like with the First World War, where on the continent, when they were being shipped across the Channel, there were, you know, violent actions towards German POWs, but they sort of came to Britain and there wasn't, that violence was missing. So I think, yeah, while the scale's a bit different from the First World War, it's a very similar sort of reception.
So you've mentioned U-boats very previously, but on the 3rd of December in 1939, there were some German prisoners of war on the U-35. Can you tell us what happened?
Yeah, so U-35 had, it sunk a few merchant ships. Werner Lott, who was the captain, the commander of the U-boat, I recently sort of found out about this, but he sunk I think it's a Greek merchant ship off the Scilly Isles, but he actually ends up rescuing pretty much all the crew.
I've seen this in contemporary newspapers under the heading "Not all U-boat captains are monsters."
Right, yeah, and I think there might be a, I think there's a memorial somewhere to this, to him doing this.
Mm.
But in with the capture of the U-boat 35, it's Lewis Lord Mountbatten who's got a sort of destroyer flotilla, and they hunt. They manage to sort of hunt the U-35, depth charge it. It's the Germans scuttle it, but Mountbatten actually manages to save the crew, and it's one of those rare instances. I'm not a massive expert on the U-boats, but it's one of the rare instances where the entire crew of a U-boat is actually saved. And so when they are they come to a port in England, and there's a lot of press coverage of this actually. Like Daily Mirror, Daily Mail in particular, have big spreads, lots of pictures, and there's a lot of newsreel coverage as well. And it's coverage of the British seamen sort of waving goodbye as the crew of the U-35 go down the gangplank. And they, it's reported to be a very sort of jokey, jovial atmosphere. They single out one of the crew of the U-35. They call Blondie, apparently. And they sing this song called "Good Old Blondie" to him as he walks down the gangplank. And it's reported that this one U-boat crew could speak English quite well and sort of bonded with them on the journey to England. The U-boat captain then comes down and he shakes hands with the British officers as if they sort of say as if it's in some token of a heroic act. So there's a lot of respect and a lot of what the newsreel commentators call a sort of camaraderie between the British and German sailors. So it's a very interesting episode.
It is, isn't it? Because you think, I mean, there's very few people who understand what it's like to be a submariner, and other submariners obviously are going to get you, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, yeah, in the sort of North Sea, they're hunting each other, but I think it's sort of, yeah, there is, at least it's reported this way in the press, that there is this camaraderie. There's pictures of them swapping cigarettes. There's reports of them, the British Navy men sort of shouting jokes at the German crew, like, come join the Navy. You're captured, you know, switch sides. So, yeah, I mean, it was really really interesting when I sort of discovered this sort of spread in the papers of this crew being arriving in England.
Let's talk a bit more about what it was like for them in England, not just the U-35, but German prisons in general. You mentioned Grisdale Hall. Tell us about it. You mentioned roughly where it is. What is it? I'm guessing big manor house. And what was it like being there?
So, yeah, Grisdale Hall causes a lot of controversy in these first months. It's where the... So there's the two camps, the one in Oldham and Grisdale. Oldham is for other ranks.
Mm.
And that gets a lot of interest with crowds of reportedly crowds of British locals in the Oldham area actually sort of scaling a nearby hill to go and view these captives and need to be ushered away by the police. And that's the other ranks that are held there. Grisdale's for officers. Mm. It's an old sort of manor house, as you say. In the Lake District, I think it's sort of rebuilt, sort of early 1900s. It's actually pulled down in the 1950s, but, it is, an absolutely beautiful place to be a prisoner of war. And again, the Daily Mail sort of, publish a lot of photographs, and it's of, these officers enjoying a nice walk around the grounds. You look on the picture and the sort of the British guard is not even, he just looks like he's having a sort of walk alongside them. He's not really guarding them. Mm. But there's pictures of them reading in a nice library. There's a great one of them all around the piano having a sing song, listening to the radio. And the reports in some of the local news and national news, they say this isn't a prisoner of war camp. This is a holiday resort. This is a spa. They sort of say, you know, it's the conditions that, you know, the hard working Brit at the moment would love to go on holiday to. It's actually, this is raised in Parliament because by sort of December 39, there's only about 21 officers there. And the Grisdale as a camp can hold about 200, and it's I think it's Colonel Josiah Wedgwood in Parliament asks the government, you know, wouldn't it be cheaper to keep them at the Ritz? So there's a lot of, you know, it's seemingly really unfair how luxurious this accommodation is for the enemy. But it also, yeah, and it sort of echoes debates back to the First World War of Donington Hall, where officers were captured. And there's very similar debates in the opening months of the Second World War, because it raises all these questions of, you know, what is the correct conduct towards prisoners? It seems with Grisdale that the British are going above and beyond to accommodate the enemy. And actually, there's a concern from several columnists. I think Major Ernest Swinton has a column in the Daily Mail, and he warns that actually the conditions at Grisdale sort of betray a characteristic of the British of being too sentimental towards the defeated enemy in a sort of way that echoes the sort of end of a sporting match. And actually he's quite concerned that the British public aren't making enough of this, and the British aren't in the right mindset to actually fight the war. You know, these are the enemy. We shouldn't be treating them in this fashion. So Grisdale Hall, it's seems like a great place to be if you are captured, but it does raise a lot of concern and debate over what the sort of correct conduct should be towards the captured enemy.
It's quite naive, though, isn't it? Because you treat the enemy how you want your guys to be treated if they're taken prisoner.
Yeah, definitely. And this is something that a point that's raised throughout the war when the letters to the editor sections of newspapers get quite heated, and it's a common theme that. When someone sort of suggests that, you know, we treat them far too kindly, the Germans would never sort of treat us like that if they win. It's that, well, you know, a lot of mothers of PAWs in Germany say, well, we've got to maintain this level of respect, whatever your thoughts towards the Germans, because it is a reciprocal arrangement.
Well, this is a total contrast to what was actually happening on the mainland in Germany, France, and everywhere around there, which brings us quite nicely to the next question, which is the Altmark incident, because this changed everything for the German POWs, didn't it? And why?
Well, the Altmark, the Altmark's a tanker, which actually resupplies the, and I always say this wrong, I think, the Graf Spee, famous for the Battle of the River Plate, the pocket battleship.
That'll do.
Yeah. And the Altmark, the Graf Spee, has taken a lot of Navy, Royal Navy prisoners from the, and merchant sailors from the ships it's sunk. They're transferred to the Altmark and it's en route back to Germany. It's spotted, and I think it is Churchill who really makes a point of trying to rescue these prisoners on board the Altmark. It's pursued into Jossing Fjord, again, hopefully I've got that pronunciation correct, by some British destroyers. The Navy boards and the Altmark and releases the prisoners. There's actually quite a sort of a bit of a firefight, with several of the Altmark's crew being seriously wounded and I think a few killed. On the one hand, this is reported as like sort of the a real victory for the Royal Navy, and a couple of diarists at the time sort of it makes them think of like the sort of heroic old actions of the Royal Navy, Trafalgar even. So for some, it's really like a boost and a tonic during the era of the sort of Boer War. It's quite an exciting incident, but the coverage in the press emphasizes that the British captives on board were bullied and treated rather poorly. Now, this is actually an exaggeration, if not completely untrue, but there's no real attempt to counter this view. And so the narrative is that there's this really perverse German captain who's referred to as like a really nasty Nazi and a big bearded Prussian bully in the press that sort of beat the British sailors on board, and it leads into the sort of, this story runs away a bit, and it leads into the sort of growing anti-German sentiment in Britain, and the social observers, the mass observation investigators, they state that really it's with the Altmark we sort of get in a crystallization of anti-German attitudes, and they consider it something of a turning point, which feeds into the growing anti-German sentiment with the, you know, disastrous campaigns that follow in Norway, the fall of France as well. And the German prisoners of war during this time go from, say, with the U-35 being these individuals that you can have a joke with and you know, have a level of humanity, to the reportage essentially makes them out to be something far more dangerous. And this leads into them being the government policy of actually removing German POWs from Britain to the Dominions, with when that threat of invasion follows after the fall of France. It was feared amongst government circles that potentially German parachutists might free the German prisoners of war. There's around about 1,000, a little over 1,000 in Britain at the time, and so they decide to actually transport them to Canada, Newfoundland, and elsewhere in the empire to remove that threat. But the Altmark and what follows with the removal of German prisoners, at this time we see that, yeah, there's a sort of changing character. The character of these German POWs has changed from something that, from a person that you could have a laugh and a joke with a little bit, to someone to be incredibly wary of, because they are incredibly dangerous.
One thing they do at the beginning of World War One with duffers and wounded men and people that aren't going to be any use to the war effort is organise exchanges. Are there any of those in World War Two?
There are a couple. In 43, I think, and later on in 44. The one that interested me the most was actually a mooted exchange. It didn't actually happen. But it's in sort of October 41 time. It's the first time they've Germany and Britain have discussed a possible exchange of infirm and sick prisoners. And it gets quite a lot of coverage because it's quite hopeful news, especially to the families of the British POWs in Germany, that there's going to be this possible exchange. And at New Haven, there's two hospital ships that are ready to sail to the French coast. They've got a number of German POWs, as well as some internees, I think, ready to transport, to pick up around 1,500 British prisoners of war and bring them back. Unfortunately, this at the sort of 11th hour, hopes are dashed. The lights on the ships go out, and it's because the Germans and British don't agree, can't find an agreement. The Germans actually, because they've got the numerical advantage in terms of how many British prisoners they've got, they argue it's an unfair exchange. And so the exchange doesn't go ahead. But there's a lot of, again, there's a bit of investigation into public attitudes towards the exchange, which is quite revealing. There's a real mixture. On the one hand, people are very disappointed this exchange can't get through because they, you know, sick and wounded, there should be an attempt to be returned. There's also a belief among certain sections of the public that essentially it's just classic German treachery, classic German character of trying to get the best out of a situation. But there's also some people who argue that exchanges didn't seem war, which I found a very interesting sort of viewpoint. They believe that such prisoner of war exchanges shouldn't actually take place. And in fact, would be unhelpful because you might send German prisoners of war who have some kind of intel or understanding of Britain back home. And finally, the sort of other element in this is Rudolf Hess. There's rumours that the reason why the exchange didn't take place in 41 was because Germany had asked Britain to include Hess, who'd obviously crashed in Scotland, and become a prisoner in the exchange.
I don't think so. I would have a guy with a broken leg who's not going to be any use. You're not having a Nazi leader back.
There are a number, and really the big event that complicates discussions of exchanges is the Shackling Crisis, which happens a year after, around about the same time in October 1942, when the Germans discover that during the commando raids on Sark and later Dieppe, that a number of German sort of soldiers have had their hands bound by the commandos who don't want them to destroy documents and want to, you know, take them prisoner and bring them back for intel. And this sort of unravels in a big reprisal cycle where Germany manacles several thousand prisoners in Germany, including a lot of Canadians. The British decide to respond in kind, but at the end recognise that British public opinion can't really countenance such reprisals. And after that, really, it complicates any discussions. It's sort of, some people turn it sort of the end of the gentlemanly period of the war, in terms of prisoner of war discussions.
Although it's weird because they have gone through exactly the same thing in World War One, with a big thing in Parliament and a big shitstorm over not of Germans retaliating to supposed bad treatment of a U-boat crew that were being held in England, and they've just gone and done exactly the same thing again.
It's exactly that. Churchill recognises he can't win in this battle of wills, and sort of trying to manage public opinion, and he goes back and looks at that, the I think it's treating submariners as war criminals during the First World War. Mm-hmm. Britain says they are war criminals, and that doesn't really go down well, because I think in the First World War, Germany then starts moving upper class prisoners towards much worse accommodation.
They put them in shit accommodation, and they locked them right down with no exercise and things. This is just off the top of my head recollection, but yeah, they went for officers.
And as a result, I mean, he sort of recognises that, in terms of like trying to battle with Hitler in a sort of reprisal cycle, there's no way British public opinion is going to sort of win out over Hitler's will to make the most out of a situation. It's quite interesting with the sort of, there's a little bit of discussion in the press of the Shacklin crisis. And again, the views of the British public, people who write in, are quite varied. Some just say, don't bother even trying to attempt to match Hitler in this game. There's one that sticks out in my memory, is that actually, and this is like sort of the opposite end of sort of the spectrum, it says, it's an older gentleman who argues, well, actually, rather than shackling in kind German prisoners of war in response, what you should do is actually try and bomb, level an entire German city, or even better, an Italian city, and then that way Mussolini can press Hitler to release them. And it's quite a bizarre argument he puts forward, because he's talking about trying to end this shackling crisis through a very, you know, attacking non-combatants. That's just one that sticks out in my memory of the episode.
Now, moving forward, quite a few years forward, to D-Day in June 1944. How many prisoners of war actually ended up in England, and was their reception as positive as it was in 1939? Because at this point, by now, the British had gotten wind of what happened at Salisbury 3. So for people who don't know what we're talking about, the Great Escape, because a group of prisoners of war were executed at that time.
Yeah, so with the D-Day landings, the subsequent breakout into France, there's a lot of German prisoners of war taken. Not all Germans, I might add. There's reports, you've got the sort of troops that have been brought over from Russia, various nationalities. When I say German prisoners of war, it's sort of just the catch-all term in terms of how they're categorised. But loads of a mounting number of prisoners captured. Initially, they have to be transported back across the channel, but this creates a problem in terms of the space in camps, which have been taken up by the Italians that have been brought across to work the fields. There's an agreement with the US called the 50-50 agreement, whereby a number of the German POWs captured by British forces are actually transferred to American custody. Well, they're still actually in British custody technically, but they'll be transported across to the US. And that solves some of the problems with the growing number. But it's from this point that the POW population in Britain of Germans just continues to increase right through to the end of the war, when there's about 200,000. And that continues to increase after the war, as they begin to be used as agricultural workers, Britain actually wants to take more in. And so the number eventually peaks around September 1946 at just over 400,000. I think during this time, a lot's happened. And I think the execution of the Great Escapers had just happened. It had just been discussed in Parliament just prior to the D-Day landings. And this, it does seem to harden attitudes towards German POWs, but amongst those people who didn't like them to begin with. And in local newspapers, there are still debates where a person will write in, and there's one, I think it's in the Gloucestershire Echo, I think. It's about the burial of four German prisoners of war. And he notes in disgust that the Schwastika flag has been draped across their coffins. And he talks about how, you know, the execution of the Great Escapers, and he's really, essentially really pissed off by this funeral in light of these executions. But then a sort of debate emerges, interestingly, where some people come in and defend this burial and say, well, the execution of the Great Escapers is horrific, but that doesn't mean as Brits we can undermine our own values and our own conduct towards the enemy. So it does provoke some pretty extreme attitudes. And the other one I remember is a bit later on in 44 is a reverend in London. He wants to organise some comforts and gifts for the German POWs in Britain for the sort of upcoming Christmas period. And one of his colleagues in the church, another reverend, he actually says, yes, sure, I'll donate something to the cause. And it's actually a tin of rat poison, which goes... And there's a big press sort of debacle over this. He says it's a joke.
It's charming, really, isn't it?
Yeah. It indicates that attitudes are much more, I think, a lot more extreme than earlier on in the war. And there's a lot more, there's a growing sort of anti-German sentiment and hatred, which is intertwined with the treatment of German prisoners of war.
You talk about that. I really want to know. So the British liberate Bergen-Belsen in 45. And obviously, this is like opening up to the world just the horrific nature of the Final Solution and the Holocaust. Did this influence treatment of German prisoners of war?
I think one of the key differences I noted, certainly in scouring through the press, is that suddenly the debates... in sort of letters to the editor and editorials on the treatment of German prisoners of war, so suddenly just disappears, which may be sort of editorial editors not publishing in letters and things about concerns about or debates about the treatment of prisoners. The only real debate and something that's tied into the stories coming out of Bergen-Belsen, but not only that, the stories at the time that are emerging from British POWs who are being evacuated, who are brought back to Britain, who've been on the death marches across Poland, with their horrific stories. The focus is really on the rations that are being given to German prisoners of war in who are working on the land in Britain, and there's a big uproar about. Juxtaposing the sort of pictures of well-fed German prisoners of war in British fields who are seemingly having a laugh and a joke with the horrific images that are coming out of Central Europe. And this does, I think, have a real impact on people's attitudes. And it seems like it silences even those people who have maintained that the average German isn't this sort of devil or inherently bellicose person. Even those voices seem to be silenced in the sort of April, May period, definitely.
So let's go into post-war. So post-war 1946, there were still German prisoners of war in Britain, obviously. What are they still doing now? Because the war is pretty much over. And had the British attitude changed at all towards them?
So I think there's sort of several reasons you could point towards. I mean, first, just the logistics of getting hundreds of thousands of prisoners repatriated when you've got a lot of other things to do post-war as well, is one of the reasons why they stick around. But really, the German prisoners of war are really crucial. They play a really significant role in agriculture in post-war Britain. And the Ministry of Agriculture is particularly keen from 45 right up to 48 to retain German prisoners of war as agricultural labourers. There is a softening of attitude. I might just add, like, it's not just agriculture they work in. Actually, over time, the German prisoners begin to work in a variety of different employments, sort of brickmaking, road mending, a host of different employments, but it's mainly agriculture that they're working in. And I think from as the distance to the end of the war increases, and around the sort of beginning of 1946, there's a softening of attitudes, or at least a sort of, there's been enough breathing space after the horrors of Belsen, and those the disclosure of those horrors.
Yeah.
It's Henry Fulk, actually, who notes this change in his book on re-education. He's a prominent figure in the re-education of German prisoners of war, and wrote a sort of a sociological study of, mm-hmm. of re-education. And he notes that it's around sort of the turn of 46 that attitudes begin to soften. And it's through 46, actually, that in local newspapers, for instance, reporters go into the camps and start to sort of, photograph and talk to the German prisoners. And one that sticks out in my mind is, I think it's sort of September 1946. I think it's Cheltenham, maybe the Cheltenham Chronicle. They go into Leckhampton Court, which is, again, it's a sort of medieval manor house, but it's for other ranks. Quite lucky. And it's really beautiful surroundings. But the report, the piece the journalist writes includes two pictures, and one's of a prisoner who's tamed a jackdaw. He's named Betty, and it's sitting on top of his head. And the others of so you've got this one picture of this guy with the jackdaw Betty that he's tamed, and another picture of all the German POWs around a sort of water feature with a beautiful sort of garden that they've made. And I think it's stories like this. When I immediately saw that sort of spread in that news story, I just immediately thought of George Orwell, who called the Brits, pigeon fanciers and flower lovers. And it seems like in 1946, after the sort of the Germans have been so dehumanized by these stories from extermination camps, concentration camps, that there's almost a sort of rehumanizing of them through these stories. And I think over the course of 1946, these stories allow German prisoners to be shown to be not so different from Brits. They have hobbies, they have lives.
Which is really interesting, because we've got to the point where we start talking about fraternisation, because some of these men have been in Britain for years now, haven't they? So when is this finally allowed? And then surely you must get the knock-on effect of this, which is marriage, love, people staying in the UK and not going back to Germany?
Yeah, definitely. So as the POWs are sort of rehumanised, the whole question of when are you going to let them outside camps becomes the issue. And the argument that is put forward, particularly by Richard Stokes, who's a Labour MP in Parliament, he argues, well, it's hypocritical for the British to preach and try and teach German prisoners the merits of democracy in the re-education programme, but then confine them behind camps. Mm. And he argues, well, surely this is, you know, the confinement of people behind camps is something that we were fighting against. So, and the fraternisation regulations, which have been in force and have evolved throughout the war, become seen as this really petty, these petty rules, like fining. One of the cases that Stokes brings up in Parliament is the woman got fined £1 for throwing a bit of cake over a barbed wire fence to a prisoner.
Shame on her.
Yeah, yeah. It's just stuff like that. It just seems really petty to people. And there's also a growing desire, particularly from the sort of churches and religious groups, to reach out to the prisoners. And there's a belief that actually, you know, ex-enemies engaging with each other will help towards future peace. A lot of pressure's put on the government, and it's sort of Christmas 1946 where they up the game, the people who were asking for fraternisation to be relaxed, by saying Christmas is the perfect time, really, to do this. And so the government finally sort of allow this. I think the police at the time are also pushing for it, certain members of the police, because I think they're just a bit sick of having to try and police it.
Yeah.
Fraternisation is a very difficult thing to police. And so they allow it at Christmas, and POWs of good nature, who've sort of shown themselves to be decent fellas, they're allowed to accept invitations from private homes to spend Christmas. And it's from that point that regulations are continued to relax over the course of early 1947. They're allowed to go to football games. They're allowed to sort of go unescorted 5 miles away from the camps. But this raises the question of, well, what if they meet a woman that they quite fancy? Because while fraternisation sort of socially is allowed, sexual fraternisation is still banned. It's still, it's what's termed as improperly consorting with British women. And there's a number of court martials that take place of German POWs who are charged with improperly consorting with women. Sometimes this involves quite young teenagers. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there's sort of an attitude that it's the women who are at fault. They're sort of Jezebels tempting these.
Oh, isn't it always the case?
Yeah. But on the other, I mean, when I think about it more, there must be an element of grooming as well. In these cases, but there's a lot of interesting sort of press reports about women and POWs being found behind bushes and in sort of sometimes in military camps by the police.
You have two really good examples in your book, though. One which is Monica Kahn and Herman, I think it's Ganter.
Yeah.
And Olive Reynolds and Verna Vetter. Could you tell us about one of those?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'll just briefly mention Monica Kahn and Herman Ganter. I find it a brilliant story. Monica Kahn, who's an ATS sergeant, she's 22, and she works in Donington at an ordnance depot. And she meets Herman Ganter, who's doing some work there, a German POW. And I think it's just, she's like, right, I love him, I'm going to marry him, and no legislation is going to get in the way. So they actually marry. She's actually charged with the false insertion of a name in a marriage register, because her and Ganter actually go and get married while it's illegal, The registrar didn't see anything wrong with it. I think Hermann Ganta, he says that, yes, I've got a German last name, but I'm actually from Liverpool. I don't know if he actually did most of the...
That's smart.
I don't know if he did any talk. I mean, he might have just nodded because his accent might give it away. I don't know. But they marry, and it raises this whole question of, like, well, is this marriage legal or not? And to come to the end of that story, well, the government decide, well, they fine Monica, I think, £4 in the end. And I think her supervisor actually pays it off. But they allow the marriage to stand. And it's around the same time that they've decided this, that the story of Olive Reynolds and Werner Vetter makes front page, well, near front page news. Vetter is charged for improperly consorting with Olive. And he's banged to rights, really, because at his court martial, Olive's there with Janet, who is their baby girl. So it's she brings the evidence to the court. He's sentenced to 12 months imprisonment in a Lodgemoor camp in Sheffield. And there's a massive public outcry because he makes a really impassioned plea in court. He says, you've denied my right to love.
And that's always how you're going to get a British audience, isn't it?
Yeah. And there's people who sort of, say, I'm doing a petition to the government. Vetter's stories, he says, I had my life had no meaning until I met Olive. She was a person who didn't look at me as like a prisoner. I was just another human. His court martial is eventually overturned, and the authorities review all the cases that have been sent them of women wanting to marry German prisoners of war, and then eventually allow this to happen. I think there's about 750 plus marriages recorded. But we don't know if, the German POWs went back home after repatriation, came back and maybe married later on.
Or people just lived in sin, inverted commas, because they didn't want the hassle.
Yeah, I mean, there's loads of interesting news reports on relationships. There's some women who simply let German prisoners of war live with them, essentially, and pretend that their husbands... there's a fantastic one I'd love to just briefly mention of Doris Blake, who ends up, she meets Alec, who I think she's met before the war briefly. She's not had a terrific marriage, or at least is not happy, and they end up stealing a racing yacht on the south coast and sailing to France, where they're arrested. Doris Blake actually, I think, goes to prison for about a month, mainly due to stealing a rather expensive racing yacht. But again, it, like Monica Cam, it shows this determination of women to, marry the person that they loved.
That story's going to make Alina cry.
I would like to say, just unfortunately for Olive, Werner actually gets deported. He wants to stay in Britain, but he gets deported after breaking and entering and thieving.
That's not the kind of happy Hollywood ending Alina wanted.
Too right, he gets deported for being a criminal.
But yeah, he ends up finding someone else in Germany back home, and Olive sort of, she goes over, and then I think somehow she loses custody of her children. It's really heartbreaking, and it just, one thing I'd like to point out, it's on the one hand, these stories of marriage and love are really sort of inspirational and really quite moving, but there are many that don't work out as well.
Where people like Werner turn out to be complete dicks.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few, I've been looking into the 1950s to try and sort of trace if... what happened to these relationships, or if they pop back into the news. And there's one or two sort of grisly murders, quite abusive relationships that turn out. I mean, sorry, lovely stories of love and you know, ex-enemies coming together and not viewing each other as enemies, but there's also, you know, real human emotion and it can be quite can turn out not great in the end.
Let's finish it off. So when were the last POWs released and what happened to them? Not each and every single one, but just like a broad look at what happened to the last of them.
So about June, July 1948, most have been repatriated. Mm-hmm. There's been a big campaign that was organised by Victor Gallant to press the government to repatriate them. From about October 1946, it's roughly 15,000 a month go home. Departing all places like Harwich, New Haven, and going to back to Germany. Some wanted to stay, but their repatriation was up. Obviously, with you know the situation in Germany, there's quite a few POWs who do want to stay in Britain rather than going back to the Soviet zone. Mm. And the devastation of Germany really. There's a lot that also really want to go home and get back to their families. The government actually offers POWs the opportunity to defer their repatriation for 2 years and take up a contract as a agricultural worker to work on farms that would like them to stay. Roughly about 20,000 take up this opportunity to stay, and I think around half end up settling permanently in Britain. I mean, one of the things with the sort of POWs that stayed, it's at a time, obviously, we've got the Windrush and a lot of furore about migrants from the Empire coming to Britain. And I think in this context, the German prisoners are sort of, they almost sort of, due to their whiteness, sort of blend into society in a way that they sort of get forgotten about. But everywhere I've been in terms of like local archives research, if I stay over and go to a pub or something and maybe someone gets chatting to me about my research, it's always, oh yeah, no, I used to know, yeah, my friend knew like someone who had two Germans on their farm, or oh yeah, there's a chap in town who his dad was a POW. So they end up all over, really. But it's, I think it's around 10,000-ish that elect to stay in Britain.
Alan, I want to say thank you for joining us and filling a gap in historiography, because a lot of the time we don't talk about German prisoners of war. We talk about British prisoners of war, Poles, Canadians, the French. We talk about everyone but the German prisoners of war. So thank you very much for joining us.
No problem. It's been really nice. Thank you both. I know everyone says this at the end of their sort of podcast session with you both, but it's been so good that you've both done this. It's been a real tonic during lockdown to be introduced to so many new topics and themes of history. So I just want to take the opportunity to thank you both.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Join us tomorrow when Freya Gowley will be with us to talk all about the history of the home. She has a new book coming out which looks at art in the home and the home, I don't know, as a piece of art maybe, how we treat our personal space and how that changed massively in the 18th century. Really, really interesting. And what's even more interesting is to go forward now and see how we're responding in similar ways as a result of being forced to lock down for coronavirus. So don't miss that. We are now on YouTube. We are posting all of our new episodes on there, and we have our own channel, and we are gradually posting all of the back episodes because we have been made aware of the fact that you can only find the last 100 on some platforms. So you can go and listen to your heart's content and laugh at the cartoons and have a great time. So do go over there and subscribe. Don't forget, you can become a patron of History Hack for as little as $1 a month. Just go to www.historyhack.podbean.com. It will help us keep going in the aftermath of the coronavirus, and we would really appreciate it, as we would love to do so.